Hello, everyone, and welcome to Outlook Live, the Federal Reserve System's audio conference series on consumer compliance topics. My name is Jason Liu, and I am the Compliance Risk Coordinator at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. It's my pleasure to be opening today's webinar on service member financial protection. The federal financial regulatory agencies are hosting this interagency discussion of service member financial protection and recent compliance issues with regard to the Service Members Civil Relief Act. Before I hand things off to our first speaker, I want to say just a few words about this event and mention some administrative and logistical details. This Outlook Live session is delivered using a webinar format. You should be receiving both the audio and video via your computer. If you experience any technical difficulties, you may access troubleshooting information through the login screen. With the webinar format, we will be advancing the presentation slides during the event. Copies of the presentation are also available for download using the event on the link on the event player or through our website at www.consumercomplianceoutlook.org. In conjunction with the Outlook Live webinars, the Federal Reserve System also publishes a quarterly newsletter titled Consumer Compliance Outlook, which is also available at the Consumer Compliance Outlook website. If you subscribe to the Outlook newsletter electronically, you will automatically be notified of future Outlook Live webinars and also receive notice when a new issue of the Outlook newsletter is released. Both programs are part of the Federal Reserve System's outreach activities and are free of charge. In addition, the webcasts and audio feeds, including today's presentation, are archived and are available for playback. To give you an overview of our session, we will begin with some opening remarks and hear presentations by the participating agencies on a number of service member issues, and we will conclude with a question and answer segment. We've received a number of email questions prior to today's presentation. At any time during the event, you may also use the online chat feature to submit additional questions. We will do our best to cover as many questions as possible, but given the amount of material we plan to cover today, we may not get to all of them. We do, however, plan to address your questions in a Q&A article in one of our quarterly Outlook newsletters. That wraps up my introductory remarks. So with that, we will begin our session with some opening remarks. First up is Sandy Bronstein, Director of the Division of Consumer and Community Affairs at the Federal Reserve Board. Sandy, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Jason. I'd like to welcome everybody also to this webinar. And we're really pleased here at the Federal Reserve. This is our second webinar that we've hosted through Outlook Live, the second one we've had with an interagency group. And today, as Jason said, we're highlighting service member financial protection matters. It's a topic that's very important to us and to the other agencies. We're delighted that there are speakers from a number of federal agencies that contribute to protecting service members as they grapple with unique challenges of handling personal finances during active duty service to our country. And today you're going to hear from speakers representing, in addition to the Federal Reserve, they're going to be representing the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Department of Treasury, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, the Department of Justice, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the National Credit Union Administration, the FDIC, and we really want to thank everybody from the other agencies that has joined us today to participate in this program. Our program will encompass not only compliance with the law, but also various program enhancements that the agencies have initiated to equip financial institutions to extend further support to service members and their families during these very challenging economic times. And I'm very pleased that I also, before I leave, get to introduce a very special speaker, who is Mrs. Holly Petraeus. And Holly serves as the Assistant Director for the Office of Service Member Affairs at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Previously, she served as the Director of the Better Business Bureau's Military Line Program, which was a partnership with the Department of Defense Financial Readiness Campaign to provide consumer education to active and retired service members and their families. Holly certainly knows firsthand from her own experience as well the strains that face America's troops and their families. She has a long history of involvement with the Army. Her son, her brother, her grandfather, and her great-grandfather served in the military, and as well, obviously, as I think everybody knows, her husband, who currently is head of the CIA, had long service in the military. And with that, I would like to introduce Holly Petraeus. Holly, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. I appreciate the introduction, and also my thanks to the Federal Reserve for hosting this webinar. I think it's a great idea. The more people we can reach with good information, the better. So I'm looking forward to hearing some of the other speakers. But I get to start off just talking a little bit for everyone about the importance of financial protections for service members and really why it matters. As you heard, I am the head of the Office of Service Member Affairs at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And one part of my job is to work on consumer protection measures for military personnel and their families. And the military is a unique population, and it does have some unique challenges. And financial protection is important for them, as well as financial education, because they also have some unique repercussions if they do get into financial difficulties. The number one cause now of service members losing their security clearances, that would be their secret or top secret clearances, is because of financial problems. And the service member who does not have a clearance often is not allowed to do the job for which they were trained because it requires a clearance. An easy example for all of you would be if, for example, they work on board a nuclear submarine, every single person on that sub from the cooks on up has to have a secret clearance. So if their clearance gets revoked, they can't do their job. And ultimately, that, of course, impacts not only them personally because they may end up having to be put out of the military, but it also impacts their military unit's readiness because they have lost a service member, from doing their job. So it's a matter of national security, really, that their finances be in order. And one of the challenges that we've seen as I've made the rounds, I've been to about 35 military installations in the past year, talked a lot to service members and their families about the financial issues that have impacted them. And I would say one of the very top ones turned out to be challenges for military homeowners. Some of the challenges were related to the Service Members Civil Relief Act, which you heard mentioned. Service members sometimes weren't aware of their rights, which basically say if you enter onto active duty with an existing mortgage, you do have some protections under the Service Member Civil Relief Act. You should be able to reduce the interest rate on that mortgage during your time on active duty, and you also have protections for non-judicial foreclosure. And not long after I got here to the CFPB, about 18 months ago, it turned out that there were a lot of banks, frankly, that did not understand that law and were not applying it properly either. The service member has to ask for the 6% interest rate and show a copy of orders, but they don't have to ask for the protection from foreclosure. And some banks didn't realize that and insisted on copies of orders or, in many cases, just the folks that were doing the, servicing the accounts for them were unaware of the law and so were telling people either they didn't qualify for relief or were asking them to send documents repeatedly, or sometimes we're setting a clock basically on their account of 365 days and then bumping them off of the protection even if they were still on active duty. So it really kind of bubbled up. We ended up having some major investigations and settlements, and I think you'll probably hear a little more about those from Eric Halperin. But another issue that popped up for me was one that was not related to the Service Members Civil Relief Act, but was nonetheless very important for military homeowners. And that was military homeowners who got caught in the economic downturn and saw the value of their homes go underwater. In other words, they ended up owing more, sometimes significantly more, on their mortgage than the house was worth. For a civilian in that situation, I realize there are many. There are some options, obviously, but some of those options were just would not work for the military, especially service members who got orders to move, what we call PCS orders, which stands for permanent change of station. That's not related to a combat deployment. That's literally when you get orders that tell you you have to move to a new assignment. It's a permanent move, but you have to do it, and usually the timeline is not that long. And what do you do when you own a house and you can't pay it off for what you could sell it for? And service members found themselves in real difficulties, partly because a number of the protections that were out there really were not geared for their situation. Many of the, you know, foreclosure prevention or loan modification programs said you had to be delinquent in order to qualify for aid. You had to obviously show that you were having trouble making your payments. Well, a lot of these military families were making their payments and had been paying on time. And a service member does not want to be told that they need to go delinquent, because then they worry, again, about their security clearance. The military takes it very seriously that, in fact, the Uniform Code of Military Justice said, has an article in there about dishonorably failing to pay your just debts. So none of them want to be told, well, come back when you're delinquent, you know, quit making payments. But we've actually seen them get that kind of advice. The other problem was that a number of the relief programs required that the home be owner-occupied. And the minute the service member left the home because they had to move on the timetable of their orders, then they were told, oh, well, now that house is no longer your principal residence. It's now an investment property. Even if you intended to come back to it, you know, it was the house you wanted to retire in, all of a sudden you were told you didn't qualify for a lot of the help programs because it was an investment property, not your principal residence. So that was a big challenge for the military as well. And I think much of this were things that were overlooked, really, when various laws and policies were written. So we spent a fair amount of time this year talking to people in Washington. I think a lot of speakers on the phone could probably tell you that, because I've harassed a number of them, telling them about the very specific, you know, challenges that military homeowners face and how difficult it can be for them to deal with them. Especially, I'm a military spouse. My husband was deployed for over 5 years to combat, and yet it can be very difficult to have a bank even deal with you if your service member is not there. So that was, you know, a big frustration for them. Some of them were being told they had to speak directly to the military member, even if they were in Afghanistan or Iraq. So I can personally say that I understand the frustrations, and I'm really pleased that in the past year we have seen a number of government agencies and some non-government enterprises as well try to see what they could do to fix this. So that's my two cents. It is a really important issue for military. Some of them have chosen to sort of solve the problem by leaving their family in the house and going by themselves to the new duty station. And I think that's really too bad, because they've already had a lot of separations due to combat deployments, and now you have families being separated because of finances. And we heard that repeatedly at the bases we went to as well, that the base commanders would have people, military members, asking for space in the barracks so they could live cheaply, because they had left their family back in the house because they couldn't figure out any way to make it work any other way without devastating their finances. So I think there's a lot of goodwill out there, a lot of people who want to turn their minds to improving the situation, and we've seen progress this year that you're going to hear about. And also some guidance coming out of our agency, along with a number of the other regulators. So I am now going to turn it over to someone who really has far more knowledge, I will confess that, than me on some of the very technical parts of our supervision, and that is Ann Thompson from the CFPB's Office of Non-Bank Supervision. And I also have with her and ready to answer questions as the afternoon goes on. Beth Frotman from my office, who is my policy analyst and, again, has a very good knowledge of these issues. So thank you all for letting me sort of weigh in at the beginning and just try to explain a little bit about why this is so very important to the military community. We ask a great deal of them, I think, and, you know, I think it's in all our interests that they be in a good, on a good financial footing and not have unintended roadblocks being thrown up in their path. So with that, Anne, over to you.
Thank you, Holly. As introduced, my name is Anne Thompson. I work for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in the Office of Non-Bank Supervision, which is part of the Division of Supervision, Enforcement, and Fair Lending. Our guidance was issued in June 2012 as interagency guidance. For CFPB, this was an extension of sections of our mortgage servicing exam procedures, which are publicly available on consumerfinance.gov. The guidance is intended to show how the exam procedures apply to service members with PCS orders and clarify the expectations for mortgage servicers who have consumers in the military. We issued this as interagency guidance with support from the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, FDIC, NCUA, and the OCC. So recognizing the challenges of PCS orders as outlined by Holly Petraeus, CFPB examiners will look at the following: failing to provide homeowners with clear and readily understandable information about their options after the service member notifies the servicer of PCS orders. Now, what this means is that servicers are expected to know the guidelines of the programs that they or their investors participate in, such as Making Home Affordable or FHA programs, and to be able to provide that information accurately and consistently to qualifying homeowners. In addition, we will look at asking homeowners to waive their rights under SCRA or other laws as a prerequisite to receiving information or having a request for assistance evaluated. Waiving rights should never be a prerequisite to getting assistance. Advising homeowners to intentionally miss payments is an area of concern, but providing factual information to homeowners about programs that are only available to delinquent homeowners, for example, would not raise this concern, as long as the servicer doesn't coach the homeowner to miss a payment or otherwise represent that they would qualify definitely if delinquent. So we want servicers to be forthright with their customers, and we want homeowners to understand clearly the bounds of each of the different options that might be available. In addition, we will look at whether servicers fail to provide a means for a homeowner to obtain information on the status of their request for assistance. And we'll look at whether or not the servicer fails to communicate in a timely manner the servicer's decision. Above all, we want servicers and homeowners to participate in sharing information and for a homeowner to understand what their options are, especially for military homeowners who are operating under short timelines associated with PCS orders. Now, a few points on supervision and how the CFPB will utilize this guidance. We'll be employing this guidance and the rest of our mortgage servicing exam procedures. As I mentioned, they're publicly available when reviewing mortgage servicers, both bank and non-bank servicers. Examiners will look at the policies and procedures to determine whether the servicer has appropriate processes for handling service members with PCS orders, including asking whether or not the service, whether or not the consumer is a member of the military and or is in receipt of PCS orders. If there are deficiencies that examiners find in a servicer's processes, CFPB may take supervisory or enforcement action depending on the facts and circumstances of the case. And I just want to mention that our supervision staff works very closely with the Office of Service Member Affairs in our office to monitor complaints from military consumers, to be alerted to any practices that we find concerning, concerning and to track issues that might necessitate any further clarification or guidance. So with that overview, I will now turn it over to Lori Maggiano of the Department of Treasury, who will talk about recent HAMP enhancements.
Thank you very much, Anne, and thank you all for tuning in to this program today. I'd like to start by just having a real high-level overview of the Treasury's Making Home Affordable program to sort of set the context. Making Home Affordable is a suite of loss mitigation foreclosure prevention options that include unemployment forbearance, modification of a principal residence, modification of a rental property that you may own. That's a very new manifestation of the program that was started on June 1st. But if you own a property that is rented or you intend to rent to someone as their primary residence, then that property is now eligible for modification. There's a principal reduction alternative, a second lien modification if your first lien is modified, and then we have some for those borrowers who are simply not don't have the financial capacity to retain homeownership, we have a home affordable foreclosure alternative program, which includes short sales and deeds in lieu of foreclosure. Most of these programs are available to loans that are owned or securitized by Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae, as well as those loans serviced by any of the 100 participating servicers who signed up to voluntarily participate in the MHA program. I am only going to address the non-GSE or non-Freddie Mac Fannie Mae portfolio at this point. Within our program, there were, as we observed after some prodding and cajoling from Holly Petraeus and her efficient staff, some impediments for service members. And so we took a very serious look at those impediments in terms of limitations on service member eligibility, and we made some very significant changes. If we could go to the next slide. And first of all, for our landmark program, which is the modification program, that program was always available only to borrowers who occupied a property as their primary residence. And I think Holly addressed this in her introductory remarks. And so, therefore, borrowers with PCS orders who were transferred and took their families with them left their homes behind, and their servicers, quite rightly, according to our guidance, said, I'm sorry, we're not able to modify your mortgage, even if you intend to come back someday and would like to retain the home. We have now changed that guidance. That change was effective last year. So hopefully borrowers, service members have been able to participate since that time. And a borrower who is displaced based on PCS orders but was occupying the property as a principal residence immediately prior to displacement, intends to reoccupy the property, and does not own any other single-family residence, that would be considered an owner-occupant for the purpose of a HAMP modification. If that borrower did own other property, then that borrower might be eligible for our HAMP Tier 2, or sort of the second version of HAMP, that provides modifications for owners of rental property. And the borrower could be, the service member could be eligible for that non-owner-occupied property if they intended to rent that property on a year-round basis, or if they've already moved and have already rented the property, perhaps to another service member who's moved in to take their place. And further, if a service member owns other single-family property but has a legal dependent who is living in the property, a parent or a grandparent, a child, you know, an adult child who wanted to stay behind perhaps to finish education, in the community where the service member has departed from, whether or not those individuals are paying rent, that would be considered a property that would be eligible under the HAMP Tier 2, which is the rental modification program. So just to recap on both of those, a borrower is considered owner-occupied for and the property is considered their primary residence, if they've been displaced due to PCS, they intend to reoccupy it sometime in the future, and they don't own any other real estate. If they do own other real estate, they would be considered for our HAMP Tier 2 modification program. And then one last point on short sales and deeds in lieu of foreclosure. Again, Holly addressed the fact that many times service members really don't want to keep the property. They can't afford to own two homes or to pay rent in two different places. They really do need to sell. However, the property is now worth less than they owe on the loan. Again, previously we had an owner-occupied requirement for our short sale and deed in lieu program, so that was only available to owner-occupants. We have now completely removed any occupancy requirement, so that is not necessary. We have also indicated that although it is a requirement that one have a hardship in order to get a short sale, so that folks with lots and lots of money who truly could support their debt don't just ask for relief of, the responsibility for an over-leveraged mortgage. We have defined hardship as being a permanent change of station, even if the service member's income has not decreased, so long as they don't have sufficient liquid assets to continue making monthly mortgage payments. And that would apply to most service members who have to now pay rent or pay a mortgage at a new location. So we have changed the eligibility requirements for our short sale and deed in lieu to accommodate service members with PCS orders, as well as our modification program. And with that, I am going to turn the microphone now over to Laura Arce from the Federal Housing Finance Agency.
Great. Thank you, Lori. Good afternoon. Again, my name is Laura Arce, and I'm a senior policy analyst at the Federal Housing Finance Agency, or FHFA. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac recently announced a number of important policy changes that affect service members, so we welcome the opportunity to talk about them today. FHFA oversees Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, so the policies I will speak on apply only to loans owner guaranteed by them, which represents about 66% of the market. As the regulator and conservator of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, FHFA is committed to ensuring that service members have immediate and automatic access to the full range of foreclosure alternatives, and that service members are not worrying about the maintenance and leasing of a property when they're in another jurisdiction doing the important job of defending our country. Recently announced changes to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac short sale guidelines merge four programs, each with distinct criteria, into a single standard short sale program, which goes into effect on November 1st. The goal of these new policies is to simplify and streamline short sale program guidelines and increase transparency and processing efficiencies for short sales in order to help more borrowers avoid foreclosure. Next slide, please. Let me review the topics I'll cover today. First, I'll give an overview of the service member benefits of the new short sale policies. Next, I'll review the new policy decision timelines and borrower communication requirements. And third, I'll discuss eligibility criteria for service members of the new standard short sale program. Then, I'll switch gears and review recent changes to the Service Member Civil Relief Act that apply to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac loans. I'll close by letting you know where to get more information. Next slide, please. Let's start with an overview of the special benefits that apply to service members with regard to the new short sale policies. These benefits are specific to service members with permanent change of station or PCS orders, which, as we heard earlier, is the official change of duty station for service members and their families. These new short sale policy changes will help service members fulfill their financial commitments when issued PCS orders by, one, making them immediately eligible for a short sale; two, at closing, providing them with an affirmative deficiency waiver for the shortage from either Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac; and third, not asking service members to contribute toward the shortage either in cash or promissory note. This third benefit is unique to service members. Next slide. So next, let's review the new decision timelines and communication requirements that servicers must follow, and which went into effect in June of this year. servicers are required to confirm receipt of the borrower response package within 3 business days and notify a borrower of missing or incomplete information within 5 business days. Servicers must also communicate a decision on the short sale request to the borrower within 30 days. If more time is needed, servicers may have an additional 30 days, but they must provide the borrower with weekly updates. A final decision must be made within 60 days of receipt of the borrower response package and short sale purchase offer. Next slide. So let's move now to borrower eligibility for the new standard short sale. First, to be eligible, it must be a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan. Second, the borrower must have an eligible hardship, such as distant employment transfer, which includes PCS orders. Third, the borrower does not have to go delinquent to be eligible. This is an important change with this new policy. And fourth, for current borrowers, the property must be their primary residence. Next slide. I'd like to speak a little more about some of the benefits of these new policies. First, normally in a short sale, a borrower is asked to contribute toward the shortage between the sales price and the amount owed. But with these changes, active duty service members will not be required to pay cash or to sign a promissory note if the home was purchased on or before June 30th of this year. Second, borrowers will receive an affirmative deficiency waiver at closing, so they will walk away from the transaction knowing exactly where they stand. This policy applies to all eligible borrowers, not just service members. And third, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac offer relocation assistance on some short sales when the borrower has a financial hardship. But since they expect those with PCS orders to be moved by the military, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are not offering the relocation assistance to service members. If this is not the case, service members should let their servicer know, and they may still be eligible to receive the relocation assistance. Next slide. So I'd like to switch gears now and talk about the Service Member Civil Relief Act, or SCRA. As we heard, SCRA is a law that provides a wide range of protections for service members. It includes provisions that provide protection from foreclosure proceedings. Changes to SCRA recently passed Congress and were signed into law by the President on August 6th. There are 3 recent SCRA changes related to protection from foreclosure proceedings. First, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac will not initiate or resume foreclosure proceedings for 12 months from the date a service member is released from active duty. This is an extension of the current 9 months. Second, they are also extending this postponement of foreclosure protection to include surviving spouses if the death is service-related. And third, these enhancements apply to service members released from active duty or surviving spouses who receive notice of death on or before December 31st of 2014. Next slide. So that brings us to the end of my presentation. You can find more information, including links to the new guidelines, on FHFA's website. FHFA appreciates the sacrifices made by our active duty service members and develop these changes and enhanced policies so service members can stay focused on their important job of protecting our nation. We'll next hear from Eric Halperin. Eric?
Thank you, Laura. And I'd like to thank my colleagues at the Federal Reserve for putting together this webinar. Today I'm going to talk to you about the DOJ's enforcement authority over the Service Member Civil Relief Act, as well as some of our recent enforcement actions. The SCRA covers a wide range of activities, everything from landlord-tenant to cell phone contracts, and DOJ can bring enforcement actions for any of those violations. But today I'm going to talk about our enforcement actions related to financial institutions. Under the statute, the department has the authority to bring an enforcement action against any person who engages in a pattern and practice of violating the SCRA or engages in a violation that raises an issue of public importance. The remedies available to the department under the statute include injunctive relief. Most prominently in our settlement would be requirements that a financial institution adopt policies and practices and submit to monitoring to ensure future compliance with the law. Damages to all persons harmed by the illegal conduct, as well as civil penalties payable to the government for each violation. Now I'm going to go over the details of some of our settlements. All our consent orders and complaints are available on our website, usdoj.gov. And so while I go over the details of these settlements, the important thing I want people to take away from it is that FCRA compliance needs to be in every facet of your operation. It involves how you bill your active duty service members when they've made a 6% request. It involves how you deal with their mortgages or other loans, not just mortgages, when they go into default. And it involves how you handle any court actions you're going to file against active duty service members. So you really need to be mindful of the FCRA in all your activities and interactions with our service members. So the first case I'd like to talk about is Capital One, U.S. v. Capital One, which is a case we settled just a few months ago. It is the department's first enterprise-wide FCRA case, and as such, it gives a sense of the broad impact that FCRA has on financial institutions and the scope of your operations that could be included within the statute. The allegations in our complaint included a failure to provide the full benefit of the 6% interest rate reduction after a valid request by a service member on to have their pre-service debt interest lowered to 6%. On credit cards, motor vehicle loans, and other accounts, there are both instances of improper denials as well as cases where the creditor provided the benefit but did not provide the full benefits available under the statute. Our complaint also alleges that the Capital One foreclosed on active duty service members without a court order. So these are service members who took out a mortgage before being on active duty or while not on active duty, and a foreclosure that took place without a court order, so a foreclosure in a non-judicial state. In addition, unlawful repossessions of motor vehicles, without a court order. And improper default judgments involving credit cards, mortgages, and motor vehicles. And this is important. On the mortgage front, I just want to take a moment to highlight one aspect of the default judgment protection under the FCRA. While a lot of attention has been focused on the fact that the FCRA prohibits foreclosing on pre-service debt for an active duty service member without a court order, also if you're foreclosing on an active duty service member no matter when they took out their mortgage or when they took out the loan and you are seeking a default judgment against them, is the obligation of the servicer or the creditor to file a lawful affidavit in court, letting the court know that the borrower is on active duty and allowing the court to determine whether or not to apply any of the other protections of the FCRA. The relief in the Capital One settlement included $12 million in payments to compensate service members and for violations under the FCRA. That includes $7 million for both the foreclosure, which would be $125,000 for each foreclosure plus any lost equity for each service member, $10,000 for any unlawful vehicle repossession plus any lost equity, $570 plus forgiveness of the amount of the judgment and post-judgment interest for each unlawful auto loan judgment or credit card default judgment. And then for 6% violations, the service member will receive a minimum of four times the amount wrongfully charged. In addition to that, for service members who were provided 6% benefits but not the full benefits of the statute, there's an additional fund to provide compensation for those individuals. The relief also includes substantial injunctive and other relief to prevent violations of the statute in the future, including a review of accounts recently obtained by Capital One from HSBC and ING Direct to determine if there were any FCRA violations in the servicing of those credit card accounts, remedying negative credit reporting resulting from the violations. The bank is required to adopt policies to ensure future compliance, including DMDC checks and reviews of files to determine whether or not someone is on active duty or otherwise protected by the FCRA. And one aspect of the Capital One settlement that is a landmark for us in our settlements is they have agreed to treat a request for 6% interest rate relief in one aspect of the business line to apply to all loans the borrower will have with the bank. And I should say the Capital One cooperated fully with the investigation and was eager to remedy any violations and provide full relief to any service members impacted. I'd also like to talk a little bit about the SCRA component of the National Servicer Settlement, which was resolved earlier in 2012. There was a separate SCRA agreement that was attached to that settlement, and it resolved allegations with the five largest servicers involving violations of what I'll call the judicial foreclosure protections. Those are the default judgment protections I mentioned earlier, the non-judicial foreclosure protections, and the interest rate provisions of the SCRA. As was the case for Capital One, there's monetary compensation for any service member whose rights were violated. There'll be a full review of all foreclosures from January 2006 to the present. And each service member whose home was taken in error will receive a minimum of about $117,000 plus any lost equity. And there is no cap on the amount of money that would be paid under this settlement. For every service member, every violation that is found, they will provide full compensation. There's also a review of any mortgages going back to 2008 for interest rate violations, and this includes not just mortgages that could have gone into foreclosure, but any mortgage where there was a valid request to lower the interest rate to 6%. And as was the case in the Capital One settlement, any service member who has a violation of that part of the statute will receive a minimum of four times the amount wrongfully charged. In addition to the monetary compensation, there's injunctive relief that is similar to what we had in Capital One, including correcting negative reporting, credit reporting, and adopting policies and procedures going forward. The final two settlements I want to talk about are settlements that occurred in 2011 against Bank of America Home Loans / Countrywide, as well as with Saxon. And these settlements really set the basis and the rubric for how we came to the SCRA settlements that have followed. They involved only foreclosures without court orders, so this is just the non-judicial protection, so only for pre-service mortgages. We found as part of our investigation that these entities failed to consistently check for military status, and multiple times they had actual or constructive notice of the military service and proceeded to foreclosure regardless. Under these settlements, Bank of America and Saxon combined, these were two separate settlements, but they were settled at the same time, agreed to pay over $20 million for any wrongful foreclosures between 2006 and the middle of 2009, and we're conducting a similar review as we have done under the National Servicer Review for foreclosures from 2009 to the present. And I should say for both for all the reviews under the National Servicer Review, we've been working closely with the bank regulatory agencies as well as with the CFPB to ensure that we're providing, you know, consistent views on the SCRA and as well as with the areas where there's overlap in the National Servicer Settlement and the ongoing regulatory reviews. We're cooperating with the OCC and the Fed very closely on those. So finally, under Bank of America and Saxon, there's similar injunctive relief as to the earlier settlements. So that is an overview of what we've done on enforcement actions to date. The most recent enforcement action against Capital One provides a good indication of issues we're looking at under the SCRA, which is the full scope of protections, not just the foreclosure protections, but especially violations of the default judgment protections as well as the interest rate protections of the SCRA. And now I'm going to turn it over to Kim Hebb.
Thanks, Eric. My name is Kimberly Hebb. I'm the Director for Compliance Policy at the OCC, and I'm very happy to be part of this informative webinar. We've just heard about the importance of providing loan protections to our active duty military members, some of the unique challenges that our military borrowers face, and stories of banks that failed to comply with the SCRA. The next several speakers are going to focus on the specific requirements of the law, the prudential regulators' supervisory expectations for financial institutions, and some best practices that banks can employ to ensure compliance with the law. I'm going to take a few moments to discuss some steps that each bank should think about when setting up their policies, procedures, and processes to maintain compliance with the SCRA. First, I'd like to start by dispelling a myth that there is any correlation between SCRA issues and a bank's proximity to a military base. There is a general misconception by some folks in the industry that they only need to be concerned with SCRA issues if they're located on or near a military base, and this is absolutely not the case. All banks that offer any type of credit products not only must comply with the SCRA, but will more than likely have a customer relationship with someone covered under the SCRA. The first step that each bank should take is to set up processes, policies, and procedures for both rate reduction requests and foreclosure and or repossession transactions. Now, these processes do not need to be standalone and can easily be incorporated into existing processes within the financial institution. For example, rate reduction requests could be incorporated with some changes into existing processes for error resolution. The important thing to keep in mind is to document and track each step in the process, be it rate reduction request or foreclosure transaction. Things that the bank should think about when developing and implementing these processes is, where is the request routed? Does it go to the compliance department, to the legal department, or a clerk in the back office? Who reviews it? What information should be included in the review? Should it be limited to or include loan information from the bank's MIS, information from the borrower request, or should the bank stop and think about what other pieces of information that it should require when processing each and every request for a rate reduction? And this could include contacting the borrower for additional pieces of information. The bank should also think about what timing requirements they are going to impose on themselves with respect to conducting the research and communicating back to the borrower. The bank should have policies around who makes the final determination. Is it someone in the compliance or risk division? Is it in combination with someone in the legal group? And is there a QA function for each of these decisions to make sure that all of the T's were crossed and all of the I's were dotted? Once a decision has been reached, the bank needs to understand and have a process for how and when this decision is communicated to the borrower. Is it a written notification or is it done orally? And if the decision was that the borrower or the loan was not eligible for SCRA protections, were these reasons sufficiently communicated to the borrower so that they can understand? Finally, are appropriate actions taken after the decision? Not just lowering an interest rate, but are the payments adjusted accordingly, or did foreclosure proceedings cease? More importantly, is how is this process documented? Can examiners read the bank's policies and procedures and conduct transaction testing by reviewing your documents and or your paper trail? While there's no specific record retention requirement within the law, the examiners are going to want to find out and be able to track what exactly the bank looked at, how they looked at it, when they looked at it, what they decided. So keep these things in mind. And as you're establishing these processes, here are a few additional things to think about. With respect to rate reduction requests, if you receive a rate reduction request for one consumer loan, it's a good idea to search for additional credit relationships that that borrower might also qualify under SCRA. While it's not required, it's not only good customer service, but could provide you with information to populate your file that you may need to access later on. You can identify within the loan file of the borrower's military status, the date of the loan, date of active military status, et cetera. If, for instance, that this loan then falls into a foreclosure or repossession status at a later date, you can also identify and or document additional credit relationships with that borrower that do not qualify for SCR protections. For example, if the loan was obtained after the borrower was on active duty status. This, again, will be additional pieces of information that you would need perhaps later on down the road. With respect to foreclosure transactions, while the Department of Defense Manpower website is a very good source for information, it's also helpful and useful if a bank contacts the borrower. You're already reaching out and sending notices if you're in the foreclosure process. So consider sending a notification about active military status and explaining the protections of the SCRA. Chances are likely that the borrower will respond if they believe they're covered by SCRA and will assist you in obtaining the appropriate information to make an SCRA determination and ensuring compliance with the law. Institutions should also consider incorporating multiple looks at military status during the foreclosure process. Most foreclosure transactions take time, months, or possibly even years. It is possible that a borrower's military status may change over time. And even if the bank has determined correctly at the beginning of a foreclosure process that the borrower does not qualify for SCRA protections, if the borrower's military status changes before the foreclosure is complete and is now protected under the SCRA, the bank is required to comply with the law. And having checked only once at the beginning of that transaction process will not be an appropriate reason to have failed to comply with the SCRA. Finally, as you take time to develop and implement these SCRA processes, you also need to think about providing employee training to understand the SCRA requirements and repercussions for your employees if the bank fails to comply. Include SCRA in the audit scope and schedule, both for rate reduction requests and the foreclosure transactions. And if the bank outsources any of these functions to third parties, the bank should be involved in developing the policies and procedures for training, audit scope and timing, and receive metrics on how these transactions are processed. These were just some helpful tips to think about when putting your process in place. Next, I'm going to turn the call over to Tanya Sweat from the NCUA, who will discuss the SCRA requirements regarding foreclosures.
Thank you, Kim. And I'd also like to thank the Federal Reserve Board for inviting me to participate in the panel today and my distinguished colleagues for sharing the platform. The Service Member Civil Relief Act has very specific protections for foreclosure actions, and financial institutions should be aware of these because they are self-effectuating. And we'll talk a little bit more about that self-effectuation shortly. Basically, the statute prohibits the sale, foreclosure, or seizure of real or personal property for a breach in an obligation or for nonpayment. If the obligation was incurred by a service member prior to the service member's military service and the loan or obligation is secured by a mortgage, deed of trust, or a similar security-type interest or lien. The prohibition applies during a service member's military service or within 9 months after the end of that military service, and it applies especially in instances when action is taken without a court order or pursuant to a written agreement. I want to focus specifically on the 9-month term in the statute. For those of you who might be familiar with the SCRA, initially, the law said the military service term or within 90 days after the term ended. In 2008, Congress and the President signed into law the Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008, which extended that 90-day period to a period of 9 months, which in 2008 was set to expire or sunset on December 29th of 2010. In 2010, that 9-month period was again extended by the Helping Heroes Keep Their Homes Act of 2010, and the current deadline or sunset provision is December 31st of 2012. Well, I'll tell you, there's been another extension. The sunset will now end on December 31st, of 2014. And that was extended by the Honoring America's Veterans and Caring for Camp Lejeune Act of 2012. The provisions under the current law don't go into effect until February 2nd of 2013, and those new provisions will extend the 9-month period to a 12-month period. So basically what I'm telling you is it'd be difficult to initiate foreclosure against a service member until 12 months after his or her service has concluded, and that goes through, as I mentioned before, December 31st of 2014. Next slide. I mentioned earlier that the provisions that involve foreclosure actions are self-effectuating. And what do I mean when I say that? When I say self-effectuating, what I'm telling you is the law is the law, and the service member does not have to ask for the protections. they are automatic. So that means a lender has to look to find out or ask to find out whether a borrower is a service member, especially if that lender is seeking to foreclose on an obligation or is seeking to foreclose on a member's home. How do you find out if a borrower is a service member? Well, the Department of Defense has been very helpful in that they've set up a Manpower Data Center webpage where you can go in and easily enter a borrower's name, and if you have the information in some instances, a Social Security number or other identifiers, and the website will immediately tell you whether a person is an active duty service member. If that doesn't work, then you always should contact the borrower and simply ask the question. And it's very important to ask because the DOD website may not contain the names of all service members covered under the Act. It hasn't been mentioned today or previously today, but I will warn you, members of the Public Health Service, members of the United States Coast Guard, as well as members of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, are also covered by SCRA, and they may not be listed in the DOD's locator or on the DOD's website. One final thought for you. If you fail to notice that a borrower is a member of the military services covered under the SCRA, the member has the right to go into court and ask for a delay in your foreclosure proceedings. So even in a state where you can start the proceedings administratively and not use the court's assistance, that assistance may be invoked by a military member. And the courts have the authority to delay your foreclosure proceedings, or they can adjust obligations in a way that will preserve the rights of both the borrower and the financial institutions. And one last thought. While we focused on home mortgages and foreclosures in today's presentation, I'll warn you, some of these protections or very similar protections extend to repossessions as well. So it's very important that you understand before you take any proceedings against personal property, you know what the law is as it relates to your borrower in that instance as well. I thank you for your time, and at this point, I'll turn the podium over to Mr. Paul Robin from the FDIC.
Thank you, Tanya, and thanks again to the Federal Reserve for hosting this important webinar. Under the SCRA, for debt incurred before the service member entered active duty service, the interest rate must be reduced to or capped at no more than 6% per year during the period of active duty service. Loan payments must be recomputed at no more than the 6% rate. And in the case of a mortgage loan, that 6% limit must continue for 1 year after the active duty service ends. In order to qualify for this interest rate reduction, the service member or the service member's spouse must provide a written request to the lender and a copy of the service member's active duty service orders. The request can be provided up to 180 days after active duty service ends. The rate reduction is effective once active duty service begins and must be applied retroactively to ensure that the rate reduction is in effect for the entire period of active duty service, or in the case of a mortgage loan, for 1 year after active duty service ends. Any interest above the 6% rate must be forgiven. The loan must be reamortized and the payment reduced. This includes waiving any fees, service charge, and renewal fees, since they would be considered interest under the Act. You should note that the 6% limit does not mean you can raise the rate to 6% if it is already set at a lower rate. A creditor can challenge the requirement to reduce the interest rate by going to court if the creditor believes and can convince the court that the service member's ability to pay a rate greater than 6% is not materially affected by the service member's active duty service. The FDIC, like the other federal banking agencies, includes a review of FCRA compliance as part of its examination programs for state non-member banks. Next slide. I want to provide a bit more information about what loans are covered by the 6% rate limitation. These provisions apply to loans made to a service member and to loans made jointly to a service member and the service member's spouse. And it doesn't matter whether the credit was extended for consumer purposes or business purposes. So even though people may think of the FCRA as a consumer protection statute, it is actually broader in scope than just consumer purpose loans. However, it's also important to note that the rate limitation provisions do not apply to federally guaranteed student loans. So the requirements here are fairly straightforward, but there are a number of them. So it's really important to ensure that training is provided to all loan department staff to ensure full compliance with the FCRA. I'm going to now turn it over to Lynette Meister with the Federal Reserve, who is going to cover other issues associated with the rate and payment reduction under the Act.
Thank you, Paul. The last few slides highlight specific aspects of compliance with the 6% interest rate reduction that we suggest you ensure are covered in your FCRA control systems, procedures, and training. As Paul mentioned, the FCRA defines interest to include service charges, renewal charges, fees, or any other charges, except bona fide interest, insurance. The service member borrower should not pay an interest rate higher than 6%, inclusive of fees and service charges. The agencies have seen instances where institutions reduced the interest rate appropriately to 6%, but then assessed late fees or service charges. The resultant effective interest rate then exceeded the 6% cap in violation of the FCRA. Of course, we should note that the 6% cap excludes charges for payment of insurance for loans subject to escrow requirements. The 6% interest rate must be effective as of the date of the order to active duty and remain in effect for the duration of active duty, plus 1 year for mortgage loans. Financial institutions should provide guidance to employees on review and interpretation of military orders and appropriate coding of service member loans in loan systems themselves. In many instances, service members notify the lender of military orders after the active duty has begun. Perhaps surprisingly, some lender software has not been capable of accepting backdated interest rate reductions to the date of the active duty. I'd encourage institutions to confirm that loan systems will accommodate compliance with this backdating requirement. The FCRA requires not only the forgiveness of interest in excess of 6%, but also prohibits acceleration of principal. One of the most common FCRA mistakes the agencies have seen is financial institution employees neglecting to ensure that once the interest rate is reduced, the corresponding periodic payment is also adjusted. Full compliance requires that both the reduction of the interest rate and reamortization of the periodic loan payment. Failure to reduce the interest rate on the loan and to reamortize the periodic payment will result in acceleration of principal in violation of FCRA. Procedures and training should emphasize the importance of executing both of these adjustments when responding to service members' military orders. Additionally, financial institution systems of control that are designed to monitor FCRA compliance should confirm that both adjustments are completed successfully. This now concludes our prepared presentations for this afternoon. I'll now turn the program back to our host to begin the Q&A portion of our program.
Thanks, Lynette. Thanks, everyone, in terms of your presentation. Before we move into the Q&A session, I did want to highlight a couple of things on the event player. Specifically, in addition to the PDF file for the presentation itself, we've attached a few resources for your information. Two of them are specifically Outlook newsletter articles that were written in 2011 specifically related to this topic. So great resources, but keep in mind that any updates after the publication of those, you would want to make sure you find out whether or not there has been any extensions of any specific deadlines. And then the third piece of resource information that was added to the viewer was the interagency guidance relating to PCS orders. So since it's been referenced a number of times in the presentation, I figured we should attach that for your reference. And it's been available through the agency websites as well. So with that, those are the resources that we've posted to the viewer. In terms of questions, I'll go ahead and kick it off by asking Ann Thompson from the CFPB some questions about PCS orders. We've received a number of requests for guidance on updating an institution's service member policy to include procedures for handling PCS orders specific to secondary market transactions. And in one case, the bank is asking, since they only do secondary market transactions, what do you suggest they do to implement the PCS guidance?
Thank you. So, specifically in terms of implementing the PCS guidance, CFPB will be looking at ways in which the institution communicates with consumers who are in receipt of PCS orders. So particularly if they are acquiring GSE loans, then they would be expected to update their policies and procedures to reflect the GSE guidance or the GSE procedures for servicing, and also to make sure that there are just basic questions or transaction basic questions that they ask a consumer in terms of, are you in receipt of a PCS order? They should train their customer service representatives to listen for phrases like, I'm being transferred to a new station, or I'm in the military and I'm being forced to move, something of that nature. But in terms of knowing the guidelines that would cover their book of business that they're acquiring, then they should just make sure that they are aware of any investor guidelines and any changes to the investor guidelines that govern those transactions.
Great. Thanks, Ann. A follow-up question to that, since the CFPB has an Office of Service Member Affairs, how big is this issue? How many service members get PCS orders in a given year?
So PCS orders are issued to one-third of the military every year. In other words, if you are a member of the military, you can expect to move approximately on average once every 3 years. So that's a very large population. We're particularly concerned with the people who get PCS orders who might find themselves financially unable to sell their house for more than what is owed on it, or that in markets where the real estate market might be slower, that they might not be able to actually conduct a sale in the amount of time that before they have to move. So we estimate that population to be about 180,000 people a year who are homeowners who will receive PCS orders, and then it's difficult to estimate exactly how many of those might be underwater or have other hardships, but at the high end, we would be looking at about 180,000 service members per year. But because this is an issue that happens every year, you will have a new population of people next year or with the next round of PCS orders who will be affected by this.
Great. Thanks, Ann. We've got a follow-up question to the first question that was asked, and specifically whether the interagency guidance creates any new requirements to help service members.
So this is not new guidance from CFPB's perspective. This is just a clarification of principles that already exist in our exam procedures, and it really tries to show some examples of how those procedures, such as asking service members to waive rights in order to be evaluated for assistance, might apply to service members with PCS orders. But we would be looking at any situation in which a consumer is asked with any sorts of rights to be considered for aid.
Great. Thanks, Anne. I'm going to shift gears a little bit. We did get some questions related to active duty and military service. So I'm going to direct these to Eric with the Department of Justice. The first question, the Service Members Civil Relief Act doesn't fully explain when active duty begins. Some sources say it must include full-time training, but not all training will be accompanied by military orders. And other sources state active duty begins on the day the service member receives their orders. What is the regulator's position of when active duty officially begins?
Great. Well, I think I hear two different parts of that question. So one part of the question is whether active duty begins upon receipt of orders at the time of actual active duty commences. And for members of reserve components, active duty under the SCRA begins when they have received orders. For active duty members in the military, active duty service begins when their service actually begins. So for reserve components, it's receipt of orders. For folks in the active duty branches, it's when their service actually begins. But if your active duty service is covered by the SCRA, meaning under it's SCRA federally protected service, then all training is included as a part of active duty. So as long as you're Title 10 military training, that will constitute active duty for SCRA protection. So military training is included as long as it's SCRA protected federal service, and then it's receipt of orders for the reserve components when active duty actually commences for members of the active duty military.
Thanks, Eric. A follow-up question to that, and you alluded to part of this as well, and the term active duty means full-time duty in active military service of the United States. When a person joins one of the four branches of the military, is a service member eligible for relief the entire time he or she is a member of service? And the question appears to seek clarification on the term military service and when certain actions like foreclosures can be taken.
Right. And I think the simple answer to the question is yes. Once you enlist in the military, you're entitled to your SCRA protections for the entire length of your service. But getting beyond the question seems to be asking is, well, does that mean I cannot foreclose or cannot take other actions because a person is in active duty service? And I think one thing I want to make clear to people is that the SCRA does not prohibit foreclosures on active duty members of the military, even for pre-service debt, or even if they cannot appear. The SCRA merely prescribes that certain procedures must be followed, but does not prohibit foreclosure. So, for example, if you are in a non-judicial state and you have a member of active duty, you know, in the example in the question, someone has a pre-service mortgage and they've signed up and they'll be serving for a long period of time. It just means you have to avail yourself of the state's judicial process in order to foreclose. You simply cannot foreclose without a court order, but you can foreclose if you seek a court order, and if when seeking a court order, you accurately complete the affidavit notifying the court that the borrower is a member of the active duty military. And at that point, as was described when we went over the foreclosure protections in the presentation, the court then has the ability to order certain protections if the service member meets the requirements, but the court also can order that foreclosure to go forward. So, yes, the protections apply the whole time. No, it does not mean that you can never foreclose. It just means you need to foreclose following the procedures set forth in the SCRA.
Great. Thanks, Eric. I'm going to ask another question with regards to the SCRA changes. The question came in, do private mortgages have to follow the SCRA changes, or do the changes only apply to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac loans?
So I guess I'll answer first, and I don't know if anyone else wants to add, but in terms of the SCRA, I don't know which changes the question is referring to, so I'm going to assume for purposes of my answer they're asking for any of the amendments to the SCRA or anything like that. The SCRA, of course, applies market-wide to any mortgage. It's not limited to Fannie or Freddie mortgages. There's been various guidance issued by certain entities, and sometimes that goes beyond SCRA protections, and in that case, that may be mortgage-specific, or servicer specific. Some servicers, as part of the national servicer settlement, have, for example, agreed to provide protection beyond the FCRA, and some servicers have voluntarily adopted policies and procedures that go well beyond what the law requires. But in terms of the actual statute, it applies to all mortgages, regardless of whether they're private label or Fannie and Freddie.
Great. Thanks, Eric. I'm going to shift gears again. We've gotten a number of questions with regards to the short sale presentation. So, Laura, I'm going to direct these to you. How does a service member apply for a short sale?
Well, the service member should first contact their servicer and complete what's called a Uniform Borrower Assistance Form, which for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is Form 710, and it's available on both of their websites. And that's sort of the portal, the entry point to getting assistance with their servicer to apply.
Okay. And a follow-up question to that. For the new standard short sale program, how do servicers document or verify that a borrower is eligible with a PCS order?
So when the borrower or service member submits the Uniform Borrower Assistance Form, it's about a 4-to-6-page form, and they're asked to indicate their hardship, which is a requirement for the short sale. One of the hardships is distant employment transfer, and PCS is listed under that. So the form will show that the service member or borrower needs to include their notice of PCS or actual PCS orders together with the Uniform Borrower Assistance Form, and that's how it's verified.
Great. We did get another question with regards to your presentation, Laura, specifically for Fannie and Freddie Mac, the new loan programs for PCS orders. You mentioned primary residences for current borrowers. Someone's asking for clarification on that terminology. And also, the follow-up question to that is, if they've moved and the property isn't rented, could they still consider that their primary residence?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So to be eligible for the new Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac standard short sale program, all current borrowers, this again we're talking about just borrowers who are current on their mortgage payments, they're not delinquent, the property must be their principal residence or primary residence. And this is true for all borrowers, including service members. So there are scenarios where a borrower may not live in the home, but it's still their principal residence. I think an important question is whether or not they've established a new principal residence somewhere else. And then the second part of your question about whether if the service member's already moved and the home is not rented, again, it's determined whether or not they've established another principal residence, but I could see a scenario where they've moved, the home is not being rented, or perhaps a family member is living in their home, but they still consider that home their primary residence or principal residence, in that case they would be eligible.
Great, thanks. Paul, we've got some questions with regards to rate reductions. So, Paul, with the FDIC, this question is directed to you. What happens if a service member does not provide the lender with a written request for the rate reduction until several months after returning home from active duty?
Okay. As indicated, the service member's request can be provided up to 180 days after active duty service ends. So in this situation, the creditor has to retroactively forgive all interest and fees over 6% and issue a credit.
Okay, great. A follow-up question. Well, this is specific to student loans. The Department of Education requires that a military person specifically ask for the 6% interest rate, but frequently borrowers send in only their orders and expect the reduction based on the orders. And I guess this person is asking, do the federal banking regulators allow the reduction on the basis of orders only? And is the Department of Education correct in demanding that both the orders and the letter requesting the 6% reduction be provided? Paul, if you could take that as well.
Okay. One thing that I want to clarify, an item that's on the slides and was mentioned during this discussion, that federal student loans are now covered by the FCRA pursuant to the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008. And prior to that time, the act did not include federal student loans, but now all student loans are covered by that.
And on your other, question, Jason, we don't have anyone in the room with the Department of Education, so we may save posting a response to that question for the Outlook article that we publish after this call.
Okay, great. Thanks, Lynette. Paul, I've got one more question for you, and this relates to spousal debt. Is the spouse of a service member covered by the Act if that person incurs debt in his or her own name prior to the time that service member enters active duty service?
No, the provisions only apply to the service member's debt or to loans made jointly to the service member and his or her spouse. So in the case of credit granted to the spouse individually, that would not be covered by the protections of the SCRA.
Okay, great. So we're nearing the time to close the session. Wanted to mention again, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, that we've received a number of very specific questions to very specific scenarios, and we do plan to write an article to address the questions we received that we didn't get to today. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up the webinar. That does conclude our time. I would like to thank all of our presenters. We were fortunate to get their perspective regarding service member financial protection, and we hope you found this presentation useful. As soon as the presentation ends and you exit the main menu, a short feedback form should appear on your screen. It may not appear if you have your pop-up blocker set. In that case, you can select the survey tab before exiting the main screen to access the feedback form. We would appreciate it if you could take just a few minutes to let us know what you liked about this presentation, any suggestions for improvement, and possible topics for future calls. I want to stress the importance of your feedback, not only on ways we can improve these events, but also on other ways in which we can continue a productive dialogue with the industry. Thanks again for joining us. That does conclude our call. Please look for future announcement on future events. Thank you.